Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com. I'm Judy Swallow in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Imitation, imitation, imitation. Is it or isn't it? Flattery. What's less debatable is this. It's how we learn to be. Imitate Jesus and Socrates, Ben Franklin urged in his autobiography. Most of us begin more humbly. A duck goes quack. 1 + 1 = 2 and make like a tree. The problem is, according to essayist Nicholas Del Banco, at a certain point we stop, at least when it comes to writing. In his Harper's Magazine piece this month, Del Banco says modern society is obsessed with originality and unwilling to allow young writers to do what was seen as essential in times past: copy, imitate, mimic, learn. It's not second rate, in fact, it's the best, well-tested road to real originality. Connection listeners, is imitation flattery or flat-out insult? And does its reputation in the writing arena need to be rewritten? Call us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined now today by Nicholas Del Banco, director of the MFA Writing Program at the University of Michigan, author of a number of books, including The Countess of Stanline Restored, and the author of this month's Harper Magazine essay, In Praise of Imitation on the Sincerest Form of Flattery. Welcome, Nicholas Del Banco. Tell me, why did you want to write? What prompted you to write this article?
Well, first of all, thank you, and second, I have a suspicion that I have really very little left to say, because you've said it all at the top of the program. If you remember, in that very play, the Hamlet from which you said to be or not to be, it ends more or less with "the rest is silence." So I'm tempted to sign off here and now.
I'd rather you didn't, on the whole.
No, I'll stay with you. In order to repeat myself, I have been teaching for really a very long time, and have grown more and more weary with the dictates of originality. I mean by that the assumption that the student, in order, I'm speaking now of creative writing, though it's true to a degree also of their critical efforts, that the student need find something that no one has addressed before in order to claim our attention. All that urgent sense of writing about a subject that is new seems to me almost entirely beside the point. I mean, I suppose if I wrote a novel about a monkey copulating with a banana peel in a space capsule, it might be a book that...
No, I've read one just like that, actually.
Well, my own sense is that the habits of mastery are acquired by the copyist's skill, and that we take that for granted in almost every other form of expression. And I mean by that from the very get-go, when we're teaching our children how to speak, you know, or clapping and hoping that they will follow that particular gesture, or showing someone how to swim or play tennis or the violin. It's all example and emulation / imitation is the way we routinely learn. Nobody would dream of picking up a violin and a piece of horsehair and starting out to perform Bach without having paid some attention to those who've done it previously.
But what are you recommending in terms of writing? Because surely there is a line to be drawn between learning from the masters and plagiarism.
Right. Again, to revert to Shakespeare and to one of the recent past present masters, there's Nabokov who says, "To borrow and to borrow and to borrow, as the bard said, with the cold in his doze." playing off, of course, of tomorrow and tomorrow, creeping in this petty pace, the Macbeth. What I recommend, and it's true both for my undergraduates and my very serious graduate students, is to enter into the world of a text with the kind of close attention that a copyist pays. You know, every time you go to a museum in this country or elsewhere, you see somebody hunched over an easel just trying to replicate as closely as possible what it was that the master performed. So I've been teaching courses in, say, Virginia Woolf, James Joyce, William Faulkner, Ernest Hemingway, and also more recently in contemporary short story writers, and making people not talk about what they're after, what the authors were up to in substantive terms, but merely in stylistic ones, and copying the number of words that characteristically fall between commas, the characteristic use of a long or a short sentence, of an ellipsis, etc., etc. And I have to say that it's been so successful that, in fact, in my terms as teacher and witness, and I believe also in terms of the student's own sense of what it is that goes into the making of an original work of art, that I've been working lately on a textbook trying to inculcate those skills of imitation in the readership.
But how far does imitation go, Professor Delbanco? I mean, would you say, you know, look, sit down and copy verbatim Moby Dick and then you'll get the feeling for how it's done? I mean, you know, painters do it, don't they? Copy a masterpiece verbatim, but would you have somebody do that with a great masterpiece?
You know, in the presentation of this textbook, I actually chose to copy all of the stories out by myself, which is to say type them over, rather than use the technology that would have been available to simply, you know, reproduce them. And in fact, for me, it was a great experience of, entering into the world of a text.
It was. Peter DeVries wrote, I was thinking it sounded like the most tedious, boring thing you could
absolutely do. Peter DeVries wrote a novel years ago, to revert to your reference to Moby Dick, and the first line of that was simply, call me, comma, Ishmael. and as opposed to Melville's call me Ishmael, or call me Ishmael. And the presence of that comma makes a world of difference, and it becomes a kind of joke, of course, an ironic tip of the cap. But it really does work. Now, I'm not proposing, and you've suggested as much, that the very best work of art be entirely slavish imitation and emulation, though, in fact, the great short story writer Borges did do that. He wrote a story called Pierre Menard, author of The Quixote, in which he talks about Pierre Menard writing The Quixote down word for word. And it's not merely the equivalent of Cervantes' text, according to Borges. It's rather greater, because Menard was conscious of his antecedent and took all of that into account also. So that act of imitation is not merely slavish. It was, though slightly tongue-in-cheek, a form of mastery. I think the ability to copy is one of the signal skills that any artist must possess.
Well, let's hear from an artist. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Jonathan is calling from Buffalo, New York. And Jonathan, you're a painter. What's your point?
Well, I think it's a very interesting point you're bringing up today. Imitation really is almost a form of homage, and it's a way that people are able to fully digest and understand what it is that they are seeing in the world around them. And when they choose to take that first step out into the real world and say, I want to produce something that is mine, you can't separate the fact that it's only yours because you stood on the shoulders of those who came before you. And Picasso, for instance, one of his greater paintings with the African masks, I mean, it was groundbreaking, but he himself took from those who came before him. And it's something that you really can't escape. When you sit down and you pay homage to an object and you want to copy it photographically, some people will criticize that and say that it's been done before, it's not creative. But when you want to take that next step into turning an object into something that is yours, you know, i.e. abstraction, which happened, you know, it was huge in the 1950s, and so many people jumped on that bandwagon and said, I want to abstract. But so many of them lacked the understanding of the classical art of copying, which is invaluable, I believe.
Well, Nicholas Delbanco, I'm sure you'd say hear, hear to that. And I mean,
hear, and CC. in fact, Jonathan, I was just in London, where they have a large show mounted at New Tate, which is going to come to America next year, I think, of Picasso and Matisse side by side, and I mean this literally. When there's a floral arrangement from the one, there's a floral arrangement of the other. When there's a portrait of the one, there's the portrait of the other. The paintings are arranged even by size.
Oh, but couldn't you say that was competition between two masters?
It was, but it was a kind of emulation, a kind of shared enterprise. And I think, just to revert to my earlier moment, point, it's not that you want to end up as a fully accomplished artist looking merely like someone you admired. It's that all of us engage in this process of imitation and emulation and competition. And finally, what I would construe to be originality is a compound of so many derivations and so many influences that, you know, it's your particular stew, it's your particular set of ingredients, but that's because you can't separate out the 17 models you had.
When do you think this split happened in writing? I mean, in the era of Shakespeare, it was perfectly all right to imitate other masters. It was fine with the great composers. I mean, the Bachs would rip everything off from each other. When do you think this happened, particularly in writing, that it was no longer acceptable?
Well, I don't think you can say it happened on August 12th, 1912, even be that precise about a general zeitgeist sort of drift. My own sense of it is that it began with the Romantics, and that we began to privilege in the early-ish part of the 19th century this notion of the individual as someone set apart from society in opposition to it, following his or her own particular lead, and that individuated expression began to be more and more celebrated, and that the fact that one was part of a tradition or would write anonymously began to be less and less acceptable. By now, of course, that has increased into an orthodoxy of its own, so that celebrity consists of being instantly recognizable as yourself and yourself alone, and it becomes more and more foolish, I think.
So the big enemy is the ego.
Once or twice in my writing life, I've been the author of something that nobody knew I wrote, but I heard quoted back or used as a reference. And that has a form of kind of reward that being recognized when you walk into a bookstore or a cocktail party doesn't necessarily carry. I mean by this that anonymity, Mr. and Mrs. Anon as the authors of our great works, probably has a more enduring value. In the end, to be known as the author of Catch-22 probably mattered less to Joseph Heller than the fact that Catch-22 became a part of common parlance.
Well, it certainly has. Nicholas Del Banco, for the moment, thanks very much indeed. We'll take a short break now. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We're talking imitation this hour, flattery or failure. Is it better to be a mediocre original or a brilliant copier? I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. This is The Connection. I'm Judy Swallow.
Say A.
You ain't got no art, you ain't.
A.
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 A. Eliza, I promise you you'll say your vowels correctly before this day is out, or there'll be no lunch, no dinner, and no chocolates.
It was the chocolates that did it. That was Audrey Hepburn and Rex Harrison in My Fair Lady. We're not talking repetition this hour. We're talking about imitation. And my guest is Nicholas Del Banco, who's written an article in defense of imitation. Nicholas Del Banco, imitation, I mean, a bit of a joke there with Audrey Hepburn, but it can be an exercise in transformation, can't it?
It certainly can, and of course that musical or that play from which it derives is the story of transformation, how somebody becomes an actual individual by having been conjured, in the Pygmalion Galatea story that's in the back of it, and then that brilliantly comic transformation of Eliza from, you know, Cockney to Countess. I do think we can imitate and to some degree fraudulently represent things by close study. The book that you referred to, The Countess of Stamine Restored, actually concerns itself with the reparation of a famous cello. It's the Countess of Stamine ex Paganini Stradivarius violoncello of 1707, and since it had been in continual use for almost 400 years, it had a certain amount of repair work to do. And I watched the luthier, a master in New York. Luthier means he who works on wooden stringed instruments, really, sort of patching, making, we're talking about something the size of my fingernail, replacing some of the wood where it had worn thin. The microscopic precision of replication of the veins in the wood, the lines of the sap, that was really quite an experience. And at the end of 2 years, to the naked eye, and the more or less tutored one as mine had become, it was still impossible to tell where the original started and where the imitation began.
You're talking about wonderful craftsmanship as well, and apprenticeship. We could go down that route. But tell me, in your writing, you know, who was your Professor Higgins? Who did you copy?
So many that, as I suggested, by now I flatter myself that my voice is recognizably mine and not all those that I emulated turn by turn. Let me change the subject slightly and refer to your repeated use of the phrase, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. That is the phrase that all of us know, and it turns out not to be the correct one. The fellow who wrote it, a man called George Colton, Charles Caleb Colton, who was in the early 19th century, 1780, 1832, I think were his dates, wrote, imitation is the sincerest of flattery. That was his line. That's the one that Bartlett's and quotes, etc. But we all associate it almost automatically with the notion of form. It is a formal enterprise to imitate someone or something else. And so I found myself, you know, imitating, emulating what I construed to be, you know, the great texts of English and certain other literatures. That being so, I used to think that I would be immediately recognized as the author of the lost sequel to the Bible or Hamlet or the Divine Comedy or what have you. But in fact, of course, you just take a little from here and a little from there. Writers are magpies. We borrow a twig from such and such an author and a scrap from such and such and a piece of rag, and then we line our own nest with it.
So it's a flattery, it's not a form. Let's take a couple of calls now. 800-43-8255, 800-43-TALK. Amanda's joining us from Galena, Illinois. Amanda, what would you like to say to Mr. Delbanco?
Yes, good morning. Greetings from Sierra Linda. I think it's the very first time I'm in a national program, so it's kind of exciting. Well, I have a question and a comment. My question is that, you know, there was a time that you guys were talking about the artists that go to the museums just to study and try to reproduce the art. Which one of them had become a master?
So are you talking against imitation? You think creation has to be original, right?
No. I tell you something. I think that was the question. Which one? Mm. Because, you know, you guys were talking about that. Which one has become a master?
Which one has become? Fair point, Nicholas Delbanco. At what point does the student become the master?
And who? I want to know specifically who that we know that went to the museums.
Well, that's a difficult one to answer, because I at least don't make a point out of stopping those people in their work and saying, give me your business card and let me see what you're up to 10 years hence. I really don't know, and I can't predict, though you can look at somebody's technique and gauge whether they're likely to be able to attain mastery of their own. I tell what I think is a lovely story in this article, which, if you'll allow me to, I'll repeat. It's about the painter Antonello da Messina, who was an apprentice in his master's studio. In painting, you know, this is really so routine as to be the rule rather than the exception. Many major canvases by people that we construe to be major and original talents have the clouds and the landscape and the secondary soldiers roughed in by somebody who was an apprentice in their studio. Anyway, Antonello was the apprentice in the studio of a 15th century Sicilian painter who fell ill almost as he had finished a large triptych. And he was doing the sort of the author's signature, by which I mean a little self-portrait off there behind the donor on the bottom left-hand corner. He fell ill because of, a malaria-bearing mosquito, and Antonello finished the work for him. And the master actually didn't die and came back from his sickbed to sort of supervise the completion of the thing. And he pronounced himself well pleased and looked very closely. And then finally at his own, what had become a portrait rather than a self-portrait, and he saw a black spot on the neck, on his own reproduced neck. And he said, what's this? And Antonello said, "Master, that's the fly that so nearly killed you." At which point, according to the story, the painter doffed his cap, placed it on his apprentice's head, and said, "Antonello, you're the master now."
Well, the moral of the story could be squash a bug and become a genius. So, Nicholas,
irreverent, ma'am.
Irreverent, ma'am. Look, let's get the argument about originality versus imitation back to writing. We're joined now by Ben Marcus, assistant professor of writing at Columbia University and author of The Age of Wire and String, and most recently, Notable American Writers. Ben Marcus, as you know, we invited you on the show because your work has been hailed by all the critics as rare and original. In fact, that's the one word you read again and again and again. Everything about this novel, said one reviewer, Notable American Women, is new and inventive. Are you an original?
Oh, I wish I was. I think that the term originality can often be applied to things that are original in the last few years. I think that the term gets used quite a bit. I think we're attracted to calling things original that in no way are. And I could take any willing reader through the library and point out all of my influences. I very much agree with Nicholas Del Banco's remark that one style, it becomes a particular stew, and a writer's task is hopefully to cover his tracks. So I early on recognized that I was helpless but to imitate everything I read. In my case, that was Donald Barthelme's stories when I was in college. So I thought, well, if I'm going to imitate everyone, no matter what, if I'm quickly going to just produce my versions of these stories, maybe I'll try to read things no one else is reading. And I'll try to assemble a set of influences that no one can really trace except me, so I can be ashamed about that for myself, but no one else.
Could you give us a quick reading of your work so we can get a flavor of it?
Sure. This is from a chronology in the book. This is something that happened in 1825 that no one really knows about. The first documented instance of the female Jesus appears in England in the form of a 7-year-old girl. Using rapid clapping and tongue clicks, the girl lures various species of birds from hundreds of miles away, who assume a circle of protection around her and raise a field of sharp wind in the area. When her father attempts to rescue her, the birds are able to beat out a rudimentary language of ricocheted wind to command his own hand against him, and he dies, a suicide. Several male witnesses also die,
and the air that the birds have stirred with their wings remains sharply turbulent at the seaside site for the next 5 years, repelling any men who try to approach. This form of barrier comes to be known as Jesus wind. It will be used against men, together with a clear sock covering women's heads, to neutralize their language at the end of sound protest in 1974.
Well, I couldn't say, well, yeah, that's some derivative Faulkner there.
Well, but we could probably point to Borges, who was an influence on me, and Borges was one of the writers who showed that you could use forms of nonfiction in order to make fiction. It might look like an essay or a piece of journalism, but there's something wrong because all the information is made up.
Two questions, Ben. You're a teacher of writing. Do you encourage imitation, and is there, you know, a sudden, I don't know, Rubicon that you cross, you suddenly say, I'm no longer derivative, or I'm no longer imitating, I'm no longer following in anybody else's footsteps. Now I'm original. Now I'm my own man.
I think that there's almost nothing but imitation, but that it's maybe not so conscious. I think certain styles and tones and ways of writing stories really prevail in a writing classroom. Some teachers, knowingly or not, advocate a certain aesthetic standard so that everyone might be writing a kind of second-rate Raymond Carver or Tobias Wolff story. And so I think we don't often recognize imitation when it happens, and things are called original that are not. But for instance, as a teacher, if a student comes in and writes a sort of Faulkner-esque story, everybody groans because we've all seen so many imitations of Faulkner that we just can't stand it anymore. But then someone else might imitate someone that no one else is reading, you know, and then that somehow is exciting to people. So this whole issue to me is bound up in what we read and what we remember. And
you know, it's really interesting that, because, Nicholas, I could swear that what we just heard Ben say there was nearly a direct quote from your article.
Well, can I respond by offering the sincerest of flattery to Ben? We're obviously in the same camp about this, but it is increasingly the case that my students are emulating him. And there's a way in which I think really all of us are more invested in covering our tracks than the need to be the case. What's so terrible about acknowledging that you come in a more or less direct line of descent from those you admired?
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Connie's joining us from Lexington, Massachusetts. Connie, I think you might disagree with our two fellows here.
No, actually, I really do agree. And I think that in all kinds of ways, all the points are well taken. I'm kind of fascinated by the idea of copying text, which was mentioned earlier, verbatim, in as much as that doesn't require technique, say, parallel to an artist copying a Leonardo da Vinci. And this, I'm all for the idea. I'm just interested into why it would work and what is behind that idea of actually just, you know, words, as opposed to using something that, say, copying style.
Nicholas, well, you know, she does have a point there. If you're copying a Da Vinci, it's very different than just, you know, getting on the typewriter. You know, the letters are all going to come out the same.
No, absolutely so. And that business of direct copying or rote learning, which we used to sort of routinely expect in the classroom, has been, in effect, discredited. What I do more routinely, Judy, is a little more complicated than that. For instance, I don't know if you remember the large dinner party in Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse, say. It's a very fancy bœuf en daube, a special French dish that takes a couple of days to prepare.
Oh, that's a lovely scene. Absolutely lovely scene, yes.
So I asked my students to imagine what would happen if the people at that dinner party were Hemingway characters. You know, how much more they would be turning to the wine than the food, or people out of Faulkner, say, at which point they would suddenly be grabbing at the bowl barehanded, or Joyce, in which case the language of consumption would be altogether altered. So what you do is you sort of fuse one form with another substance and see what happens there.
Divine Comedy in the manner of Dostoevsky. Ben Marcus, did you use that sort of technique?
Well, I do, and I think it's also interesting to have students, for example, take a Beckett text and turn it into a Faulkner one to try to see if we can separate style from content. And like Connie, I think it's far easier simply to copy word for word than to copy style or tone. And what I find with students is they're often in a stylistic or tonal camp that they're not even aware of. So I'm not sure if Nicholas Delmonico saw this also, but for many years everyone wrote a Raymond Carver short story. And then, of course, students who had never read Raymond Carver wrote Raymond Carver stories. So that styles prevail that we're not aware of. And it's interesting to have students read these original people and see where their styles come from, to trace it back. And that may or may not end up translating back to their own work, to deepen their own style, to cause them to try new things.
What do you think about that, Connie? You know, combining two styles, is that an acceptable answer to you?
Well, that makes a lot of sense to me, and that seemed, in a sense, maybe a traditional exercise that is very logical to me. I was wondering if, in fact, there was some something to be gained from copying the text by text, as he had mentioned doing, instead of cutting and pasting all these stories.
Right.
What do you think about that?
I'm kind of interested in that deeper or more I don't know. It's kind of an interesting idea to me.
Thank you. Yeah, Nicholas,
this is something that we haven't really talked about yet. I think the act of reading and writing are really two sides of the same coin, and every writer I know, the lowest as well as perhaps the highest common denominator, is how seriously they read. So to get you to write better, you must, you know, read better or more closely, almost as a precondition of liberating the imagination and loosening your own tongue. You have to learn to copy those of others. That being so, I think the literal copying is a way of getting into the text.
Ben Marcus, I'd like to say thanks very much for joining us this section. Ben Marcus, author of The Age of Wire and String, and most recently Notable American Writers. So what do you think? Are there no more Mozarts and Shakespeare's, because we all want to be them, don't want to copy them? I should have said Notable American Women was Ben Marcus's book there. Is it time to relearn the art of imitation is our question on The Connection. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow, this is The Connection from NPR. Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com. I'm Judy Swallow, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. How to be a Shakespeare? Copy Shakespeare. Ditto Faulkner and all the rest of the greats. There's nothing new under the sun. To be great, copy the greats. We're talking the lost art of imitation this hour. 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK to join the conversation. My guest today, Nicholas Delbanco, director of the MFA Writing Program at the University of Michigan, an author, and more importantly, in this context, the man who wrote in this month's Harper's Magazine about In Praise of Imitation on the Sincerest Form of Flattery. Nicholas Delbanco, we've had a lot of fun with this argument in the course of the program, but really, is there a serious point here, a serious policy recommendation you're making? You know, it's time to change the school curriculum.
Well, I do think two things about the school curriculum that could use the improving, and the first attaches to the last thing I was saying, this habit of close reading, with which I at least was schooled, or was the bar to which I was raised, as it were, has all too often, in my opinion, been accustomed, honored in the breach in the academy of late. I really want my students, and indeed all students, to pay attention to the text. And this is one genuine way of enabling that. And the second is that while we're in school, wouldn't it be nice to leave the matter of the substance aside so that we can focus on style, so that we can acquire, as it were, without feeling shamefaced about it, the very technique that will permit us, when we are on our own, to be legitimately on our own?
Oh, dear, I think saying leave out the substance, focus on style, you might say it's the disease of the 20th century. But I think I was taking different meanings from those two words. I mean, what I'm trying to get is, are you saying that when the teacher stands in front of the classroom, you ought to be doing something completely different? You're getting it wrong.
I'm talking, I was again using my little doubling formulation there. The first part of my answer was about reading. The second was about writing. If I were to tell a class of a dozen or 200 students to write a short story about a fellow in a car in a mountainous landscape, and someone tied to the train track just around the next bend, I would get 12 to 200 separate versions of that, even though the substance had been preordained. You see what I'm saying?
I think you're saying make boundaries. Don't just say, go on there, kids, be creative. The pressure of be creative is so great.
You should
break it down and learn one skill at a time.
If I may shamelessly read from my article, and it isn't so shameful because I'm quoting someone else.
Be shameless.
The great late poet and scholar A.K. Ramanujan, he was discussing the process by which Indian musicians acquire mastery, and this is what he had to say. They want the influence. They've all apprenticed themselves to the master. This is the way traditional Indian musicians will learn. They'll sit behind the singer and sing along with him, just droning. Then gradually the master will ask the disciple to join his voice to his. He'll do it for several years. At the end of it, the master's gone, and the disciple is left to sing the song. It is through imitation that you learn. It is through following in the master's line. This was true of the poets and every other artist. The poet says, I will show you one more thing that the tradition can do. End quote. And I'm not suggesting, of course, that we consign the whole notion of originality to the woodshed and call it anathema. In the end, that is what counts. But it's the getting there that I want to change. It's the methodology of instruction that seems to me we would do much better by saying, here's something, copy it, or at least enter into it.
Nicholas, a lot of people want to talk to you. Let's get through a few of them. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. And Matthew joins us from Cincinnati, Ohio. Matthew, you want to pick up that point about music?
Yes, very much so. Right now I'm a student at the Cincinnati Conservatory of Music, and mm-hmm. I'm becoming an orchestral musician, and I'm very much in the process of trying to find my own voice after many years of imitating my teachers and those that I've listened to on recordings and things of that nature. I know that especially in the classical music, training and upbringing, imitation is by far one of the most important aspects of that, because you get your recordings of vocalists or instrumentalists, and you listen to that and you find different aspects of their performance that you like, and you take that, I guess you kind of put that into your own, try to master their way of doing it. And now with the prevalence of recording, things of that nature, there are so many different styles and influences that an individual can have, and especially here in America, I've found that, at least in the orchestral part of classical music, there's a lot of America's also the melting pot that way, also as far as styles, and there's not so many very definitive ways of doing things. There are differences between Chicago and New York and Boston and things like that, but in Vienna, the Vienna Philharmonic has played pretty much the same way for centuries, and it's very valid and very wonderful way of doing things, and it's perpetuated by the training of musicians within that area of the world.
But Matthew, what I find fascinating, what you say, is the aim is to gather in all these influences to find your own voice, very much like a writer would be doing. I mean, when do you know you've reached that point, and will you have felt you've totally failed if you're still third violinist, if you are a violinist, in some lesser orchestra in 40 years' time?
Matthew, it's not an accident that I wrote that book about the cello, because it belongs to my father-in-law, who is, the, to my mind, the great cellist Bernard Greenhouse, and he was the student of the very great and very famous cellist Pablo Casals for years in Prague, and he tells a story that really encapsulates this point, or answers to it, I think. He studied with Casals on an almost daily basis for a couple of years, and for the first 3 months, they worked only on one of the Bach cello suites. And every time that Bernie got the intonation wrong, the bowing, the fingering, what have you, Casals would slam down his instrument and say, no, 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 you must do it exactly this way, exactly the way I performed it. And at one point, very gingerly, Greenhouse suggested that he didn't want to be a carbon copy of the master, because all he would be is known as, you know, second in command. Casals would hear none of that and insisted on perfect imitation until finally they could perform the minor suite as if it were sort of two cellos in the one room, stereophonic sounding. And when that was over, when he'd gotten it, as it were, right, Casals said, okay, you put down your cello and you listen to me. At which point he played the same piece of music. He changed every fingering, every bowing, all the intonations at the top of the phrase, absolutely everything, and smiled and with a great grin said, good, that's the way we'll start to talk about Bach from here on in. Improvisation, as it were.
Matthew, thanks for your call. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's come back to writing now with Keith in Port Edwards, Wisconsin. Keith.
Yes, I found your comments about, you know, kind of sitting down and copying rote, and I'm an educator and kind of a reader and stuff, but I believe that, you know, we're kind of talking about body memory, and if you take the time to do that, it seems like, you know, you're probably adapting the phrasing, the timing, et cetera. And I guess the other thing is that in the form of mankind, of course, styles can represent evolution of times and man, but good style seems like, because of us being hardwired, has kind of a uniformity through it too, and but I think just kind of body memory and almost kind of a meditative act. Monks, for instance, I think in past you know, past times, did a lot of copying and stuff. So I'll just sit back and listen to your comments,
Keith.
And I will imitate myself, Keith, and from the top of the show, and say the rest is silence. I think you're exactly right.
But Nicholas, I think the point he was making there, or it was almost as if a writer is absorbing influences, a bit like an actor getting into a part.
I think that's right. An actor enters into a role by you know, deciding what his or her model would be wearing, eating, dreaming, what their diction consists of, what their bodily twitches look like in the mirror, and the more imitation and mimicry, after all, miming are mimesis, which is the original, the root word for them all. The act of copying, that's absolutely intrinsic to our nature. I'll say it again, it's what children do by way of growing up.
We have to repeat things on this program. It's where we're learning. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Margaret's joining us from Medfield. Margaret.
Yes, hi. I was just astonished at what the professor has to say, because I was a professor myself. And I'd like to remind him about what Melville said in the 1800s. He said something, it went like this: let us fail in originality rather than succeed in imitation. So my question to the professor is, how do you guide your students to try for originality rather than for imitation, even if they succeed in imitation? Aren't you giving them wrong guidelines? I was just listening to President Bush on Wall Street. He just talked about moral confusion and relativism. Isn't that something that you're guiding your students into rather than away from?
So well, you're glad to, bad originality worse than good imitation, Nicholas. Ooh.
I'm glad to have something approximating a contrary opinion because we've all been agreeing with each other for the bulk of the hour. Melville, I would have to say, is the exception that proves the rule, by which I mean he was a great genius and went at a certain stage in his artistic development, I think, beyond any of his masters. But the flat fact of it is that he read omnivorously, voluminously, and borrowed great swatches of those he construed to be his predecessors, whole cloth early on. So, of course, in the end, what I hope for my students is that they fail in originality. My point is merely and surely, but it is my point, that we have a better chance at originality if we've mastered the skills of copying.
Margaret, thanks for your call. Nicholas, one last point. All these self-help books, do you think, you know, discovering yourself books, do you think there is a sort of cult of originality, cult of personality, which works against creativity?
Oh, I do think so, and I think what Ben Marcus was saying is opposite to this too, that there's a certain cycle to what we construe to be original. In fact, flatteringly, a fellow picked up on this notion in the New York Times over this last Sunday. Guy Trebe, his name is, and he wrote an article on fashion, I mean, quite literally, the designers, in which he quoted the article and said that designers aren't daring to admit that what they're doing is quite literally ripping off sometimes from the rack something that seemed forgotten because it was 10 to 40 years old.
And I read that, they do it historically. Is that better?
Yes,
with? I mean,
exactly.
what if you were copying one of your contemporaries? Would that be worse than ripping
That's
off Shakespeare
closer to
or
plagiarism.
Faulkner?
Yes, better that they should be in the public domain to revert to your fear of plagiarism. But I think of it finally, as the way George Colton expressed it, I really do think that imitation is a form of praise. You can, of course, insult your models by caricaturing them, by taking an aspect of their work and overstating it to make the case. But by and large, it seems to me that those who follow the leader do so because they construe that person has something worth the following.
Nicholas Delbanco, thanks very much indeed. My guest today, Nicholas Delbanco of the University of Michigan, author and also author of an article in this month's Harper's Magazine in praise of imitation, as you may have guessed. Earlier we spoke to Ben Marcus, assistant professor of writing at Columbia University and author most recently of Notable American Women. Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation online at www.theconnection.org. I'm Judy Swallow, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
But use proper English, you're regarded as a freak. Oh, why can't the English? Why can't the English learn to speak?